Hi, I'm Kelly Cervantes, and this is Seizing Life, a monthly podcast produced by Cure Epilepsy. Today, I'm happy to welcome Laura Boretsky to the podcast. Laura was diagnosed with intractable epilepsy and complex partial seizures at the age of six. She is here today to share her epilepsy journey, which encompasses many of the issues we've discussed on the podcast, from workplace discrimination to parenting with epilepsy to life-changing surgery. Laura has experienced all of it and has written about it on her blog and in her recently published book entitled Seizing Control. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. To start things off, why don't you tell us about when and how you had your first seizure?
The first one that I remember, I had in my apartment, which was in Queens, New York City. I was playing with what are called tylets. They're basically two-dimensional Legos. I was just kind of taking little plastic pieces and poking them in the tray there. And I felt this really strange sensation in my tummy, and kind of grounded myself by looking around the room, just took note of the beds and the toy chest and the details, saw I was where I should be. But then that feeling kept spreading and didn't know what it was. So I just called out to my mother, who was in the kitchen. It was a small apartment. She heard me. And then I blanked out. This is when I was about five or six. And I know she called an ambulance because the next thing I knew, I was in the hospital, Elmhurst Hospital. The next day, it was, you know, overnight and stuff. I will say that that's not the first seizure I had. The very first one my mother told me about. I was little. I was like two. And she took me to the doctor at that point, too. They said this could be febrile seizures. This could be temporary. They put me on like Ativan or some kind of quick fix med. And everybody crossed their fingers that was it. But of course, 3 years later, the seizure I described that I recall, that's what happened.
Did they give you any idea as to why you might have had the seizure?
The second one?
Correct.
Yeah, I guess at that point, I think they diagnosed it as epilepsy because probably my mother recalled the first one for them. And they put me on Dilantin right after that. And I had to have an EEG done. This is back in the day where it was the gooey, sticky stuff with this curly hair. It was really unfun. And then within 6 months, I had a second grand mal. That year I had two, and I remember them both really well. And so then they started the medication guessing game, which is not uncommon. And there were fewer meds to choose from back then because this was early 70s.
Did your mother tell you any of the advice that the doctors gave her at the time or guidance that she was given in how to care for you?
I don't remember that. I think everybody was just kind of nail biting, crossing fingers and saying, okay, we're going to follow the doctor's orders here. I was lucky to live in New York City, lucky in that there's really good teaching hospitals in big cities. So I was treated at Mount Sinai those years, which is, you know, excellent quality of care there. But again, it was 50 years ago, so there just wasn't, they didn't know as much. They didn't know as much. Epileptologists didn't exist back then. I saw a pediatric neurologist for sure.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You were able to get a modicum of control in your childhood of the seizures, but that sort of went away when you hit adolescence. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, right. That is correct. I'd say between age 6, 7 until 13, the epilepsy, it was there. I think it was almost like just kind of this thing looming in the background. There's something a little off about my body, and I know that, but the seizures that occurred were small enough. I can't even recall the details between 6 and 13. Then adolescence hit. It was a very tumultuous time in my life. A lot of moving, my father going through his second round of divorces. And I had two grand mals within 6 months of each other. The first grand mals since those others I had when I was a little kid, when I was about six. One at school, one at home. One in front of one set of friends in New York, one in front of another set of friends in Western Mass. And so then there was more guessing to be done. And they tweaked the meds and I got a modicum of control with the grand mals. I didn't have grand mals for 15 years after that, but it was a lot of like tweaking I still had complex partials. I was never able to get the complex partials under full control. I went through a series of meds for decades.
And tell us what those might look like to someone who was watching you have one and what they felt like as you experienced one.
So they started with an aura, or which could also be called a simple seizure, which is just sort of like a little creeping sensation in my tummy that crept to my face. If I was lucky, it would end there. Then I'd call it a simple seizure. But they often progress to the complex partials, at which point I would blank out. I had a lot of tongue clicking, sometimes walking around in circles, kind of, it depends on where I was. Sometimes I just want to get away from where I was and I was on autopilot. Sometimes I'm like nonsensical, yelling out loud, saying words over and over again. I had the one in my book that my friends recalled for me. I was asking what time it was. I think that was actually something I often did, was look at my watch. Again, it was a grounding thing. Okay, I want to ground myself in the reality of now. I also took notes. You know, I tracked what time of day did these happen, just so I had the detail to share with my doctor. Was it more likely a certain time of day? Honestly, I didn't notice a pattern necessarily, but I tracked it like so carefully, like a scientist.
And when you were experiencing them, did you know what you were doing? Did you know the repetitive behavior?
No.
Or did sort of black out during
I blacked out. I can tell you all this because I had people explain it to me, recall it for me, but I blacked out after the sensation crept from my belly to my face, and I felt like kind of scared because I knew it was coming. I knew I was losing control, and I felt very anxious and scared in the moment. And then I would blank out. So, you know, it was like anxious and scared because here we go again. I'm going to be out of it. And I'm not sure who's going to see what. I'm not necessarily sure who's around me, you know, if I'm out and about in the street, you know.
That has to be so anxiety inducing, not knowing when it's going to happen. And then it starts to happen and you have no control to prevent it or to stop it. And you're not in your body for a few minutes.
Right. You're not aware of it. You're in it, but you don't know what's going on. And then you have to rely on others. If you're lucky, there was somebody that you knew who you trust who would tell you, but just as often there wasn't.
Now, how did those seizures impact you socially and academically as you're talking, you know, being a teenager and having these seizures?
Academically, I was actually pretty lucky that they were infrequent enough and didn't impact my cognitive abilities at all. So I couldn't do my work if I was having a seizure. But as I said, they were infrequent enough that I could, you know, make it up, you know, do it the rest of the time. And I did fine academically. Finished high school, but at 17, and went on to college. Socially, you know, what affected me just as much was A, the fact that I moved a lot during junior high and high school, and B, I have this very unique hair that made me stand out like a sore thumb every time I started in a new school, and that affected me just as much as the seizures. And so because I had this hair, I was really good at figuring out who the kind people were. And the people who were going to accept me because of the way I looked, I had a good sense of who they were, and I kind of knew I knew intuitively that those are people, they would also be able to handle this other aspect of me that's a little bit unique and, you know, off-putting to some, and so on.
And you did go to college. Were you or your parents, were you nervous about how your seizures might affect you at school? I guess it had been a while since you'd had a tonic-clonic, so
right.
That was probably pretty encouraging. But I wonder if you can speak about how your epilepsy impacted your college experience.
You know, I didn't keep as careful notes back then, but I know because I think it was sort of a quieter time with the seizures. I think they were complex partials only for this whole period between age 13 and age 28. So they were smaller. And so if they were going to happen, I knew it wouldn't be, or I felt there's a good chance. I guess you never know. But I just assumed it would be just a complex partial that wouldn't take me out for too long. And they weren't as frequent as they became when I hit my 30s, basically. And so I honestly didn't think about it that much. I really didn't let it impact me. I was able to because it was sort of in the background. I still had meds. I switched them out, you know, here and there. There probably was the occasional seizure, but again, it was small enough that it was, I don't remember it being a huge deal. I kind of remember it more recently than that, because again, that's where the seizures started to uptick a little.
Hi, this is Brandon from Cure Epilepsy. Do you have questions about seizures, medications, treatments, or other areas of epilepsy? Cure Epilepsy's new video series, Epilepsy Explained, provides answers to help you better understand the basics of epilepsy. Each month, a different expert offers short, easily understandable answers to questions from our community about a particular area of epilepsy. Doctors and researchers who are leaders in their field will cover questions about seizures, diagnosing epilepsy, medications, surgery, and many more topics. New episodes of Epilepsy Explained will be available on Cure Epilepsy's website and YouTube channel on the third Wednesday of every month. Now back to Seizing Life.
So Laura, you're entering the workforce and at the same time experiencing this uptick in your seizures. How did that impact your work life? And did your employers know?
My employers eventually knew. I, especially when I first started working, the number of seizures was lower. Again, I had no incidences of the tonic-clonics. I was like, okay, I'll just have to, if it happens at work, I'll roll with it. My employers will have to roll with it. I've been rolling with it, you know, my whole life. So I never told people when I applied for jobs. I went over those questions. I'm sure I came across those questions. Do you have a disability? And read the definition and thought no at that point, because the seizures were a pain in the butt for sure, but I felt like they were small enough they didn't impact me. And so because I checked no, and it certainly wasn't something I wanted to share on a job interview, you're trying to, you know, put your best face forward and impress, you know, impress for success. You don't talk about health conditions. I don't think I've ever done that. However, that said, I had my jobs. I got there, and eventually, I would get outed, you know. And I had one job for 12 years where I was all over the place. It was just that kind of job where I was in various different places. So, like the seizure, it happened when I was at the welfare office over in Roslindale, not at my main office downtown, you know. So, who saw it? Again, it varied. But my manager at that point, I'm sure I told my managers here, I have this, didn't hide it. And so I never felt like my employment was at risk at that job. I was there between 89 and 2002.
But then you did end up at a job later on where you did experience discrimination. I'm wondering if you can share that with us.
Absolutely, sure. So that led with a grandma that I had at the office. It was the first tonic-clonic or grandma seizure I had in about 10 years. It sort of like 10 years prior, and also this one at the office. It was out of the blue. I was kind of used to having the complex partials, but then these were the big ones where when you think of the word seizure, this is what people think of. You're shaking, you lose consciousness, you fall to the ground, you stiffen, you froth at the mouth, really big. And so this happened at my office, and my colleagues had to call 911, and I had to go to the hospital and call my then boyfriend, now husband, to pick me up. It was very disruptive. And following that, I noticed a series of negative response from my manager and her manager, doing things like I got a very poor evaluation, which was so unexpected. And I worked hard to, like, you know, try to correct the things she noted. And then that was followed by an okay evaluation, which was followed by something, again, really negative. And what I noticed is the trouble started shortly after that grandma at the office, and kind of continued as I had an uptick in seizures at the office, not tonic-clonics, but complex partials that people noticed. So during a staff meeting, for example, that happened, I kind of very clearly remember there was one week where I had two or three by chance at the office, and my department head said, oh, can you please give an explanation to the staff about what you have, what epilepsy is? And I was like, I can do that, but is this legal what you're asking me to do? I'm not sure, but okay, I'll do it. And so I did. But all of this kind of led me to believe that my managers were intentionally trying to make me uncomfortable. And so when I got that negative eval at some point, I reached out, we had union reps, I reached out to them. I said, I'm not agreeing to this because I feel like this is unfair. I pushed back and I called, there was a process. You call for a hearing, a meeting, a grievance. But in between there, I got pregnant and I took my maternity leave. So I was literally grieving this eval while on leave, while nursing, going through paperwork, looking at the emails that I sent myself and sharing them with the union rep and figuring out how to navigate it. And I do believe in retrospect, they definitely expected I'd not come back. You get 6 months paid in maternity leave. They figured I'd just quit somewhere after January when my son was born, somewhere in that 6 month period. But I was like, no, I'm not going to quit because what you're doing is wrong. So I went back and picked up the grievance process. It was on hold while I was on leave. We picked it up when I got back. And that's kind of when I said, look, what I think is going on here is discrimination due to my epilepsy. You could, you know, if you're worried about people seeing me have seizures, important people like donors, because I'm a fundraiser, give me a different job that's a little more behind the scenes. But it's not fair to just say, to say you're doing a bad job when it's wrong, when it's incorrect. And ultimately, they offered me a severance package. I asked for 5 years pay. They offered in the end 1 year pay. And at that point, it was so unpleasant. I certainly didn't want to work for them anymore. But I was like, well, they initially offered 6 months, then they upped it to a year. I guess I'm doing okay. Let's just accept that and leave.
I love that you're sharing this story, that you are, you're clearly a very powerful self-advocate. And I think that that is so incredibly necessary for people who fear they may be facing discrimination in the workplace, to know how to handle that, to know what the process is. I want to sort of go back a little bit in your story because you mentioned that you had taken maternity leave. You have two children.
Yes.
And that can be a really tricky tightrope to balance on being a woman with epilepsy, just getting pregnant, and then parenting. What were the conversations like that you had with your neurologist, with your OBGYN to prepare for pregnancy?
So with the OBGYN, you know, I was equally as concerned about my age because I got pregnant late in life. I was 39 the first time. And so I was just very worried about just complications that occurred for any older mom. But then in addition to that, obviously I had the complications of managing epilepsy and making sure I was on a medication that didn't have teratogenic effects, which are, you know, handed down to the developing fetus, right? Negative effects. So the first thing was talking to my doctor at the time and changing my medication regimen to one that wouldn't have bad effects on a developing baby. And then I did have conversations about, okay, what about the safety of this? Like, you know, when I'm out there in the world, because I live in a very walkable city, and the seizures, like, my experience of the seizures, they were, again, mostly complex partials at that point, was that, yes, this is going to be an imperfect situation if I'm out there pushing a stroller at the playground or what have you with a little child. But I felt like I would recover quickly enough that it would be a small enough window that there's a good chance we'd be okay. And so I asked my doctor, I said, does that make sense to you? Do you think I should get a nanny if I'm alone with my kids? And she said, no, the patients I have who have nannies with your kind of seizures are the ones that just really want the help because they want the help, not because they're concerned about the seizures. So I went with that because it was my own intuition, but also she kind of validated what I thought based on what she knew of my health history. So, you know, I took measures like I had a strap on the stroller, which I kept on my wrist. I had a tag on the stroller that explained my mom has epilepsy. I don't think anybody ever looked at that tag. I can recall about 10 times when I was just sort of out and about at the playground, at a store, whatever, with my children, and people around me on the subway, people around me saw me having a complex partial and got very worried for my kids and called 911. And every time that happened, by the time the medics got there, I was fine. I was totally, you know, recovered from the seizure. Well, you can, totally, maybe that's an exaggeration. I was in the postictal phase. So I was cognitively aware. I could sign the paperwork saying I'm fine. I knew where I was, what was going to happen next. I just knew it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was aware enough to say, okay, oh yeah, I was on my way home from the post office. Time to get back to the house, that kind of thing. But, you know, it was rattling. That is a rattling experience because I knew that the kids were at risk in that little brief window. It's rattling to have to deal with anybody in an official capacity because of your own health issue. That just doesn't feel good. It's disconcerting. It was, you know, when the kids were old enough to remember it, it was disconcerting for them. And I knew that.
So you continue to have these seizures. The kids are getting older. It's, you know, you're trying to navigate parenting with all of this. And then at some point, you decided to explore surgery. Talk to us about the journey that you went on before deciding to have brain surgery.
So the journey was what I described a moment ago, right? Just kind of being out there and knowing there was this risk kind of inherently there, the 10 times that medics were called, which never felt good. And then what happened was in July 2013, so my kids were 4 and 6. I was coming home from the office. My kids were at a camp program and then being picked up by a friend, everything. They weren't with me. And I had a grand mal seizure right in my neighborhood, right in the square by the subway stop. And somebody called 911. I landed in the local hospital here in Somerville. And all I could think was, oh my goodness, my kids could have been with me. I only worked part-time. I still spent lots of time being the primary caretaker alone with them. Had they been with me, this would have been so scary for them, so disastrous. They would have landed in the local police precinct. And just, you know, that's all I could picture was that. And so that's what launched my brain surgery project, all the research, you know, because I wasn't going to do it lightly. It was scary. It was definitely a scary endeavor. But that's when it started, August 2013. I went to the neurologist. She checked me in for the week-long EEG monitoring that happens.
When the doctors were explaining the surgery to you, so you say you were connected for the week-long stay, I'm assuming so they could try and figure out exactly where the seizures were coming from to decide right. If any sort of removal was a possibility. When the doctors sort of gave you their evaluation, what was their prognosis if you decided to go forward with the surgery?
Well, you know, an EEG, my sense of it is really just a snapshot in time of what's going on in your brain in that moment, or in that case, that week, right? And so, you know, eventually they did get it on tape. And so then they could see, okay, yeah, we can tell the seizures, the misfiring neurons are, they seem to be clustered over here, right temporal lobe. And so that's good because they seem to be clustered in one place. And then they could really confirm that with the WADA test, it's called, which is named after a person. It's not an acronym. It's named after somebody whose last name is WADA. And that was a wild ride, that test itself, because what they do is they put half your brain to sleep at a time. So they insert barbiturates through a needle in your groin and tube it up to your head and put half your brain to sleep at a time. And my neurologist was there showing me the flashcards saying, okay, what's this? What's this? Do you remember what I showed you? And I could answer those questions perfectly when the left side of my brain was awake. But when my right side of the brain was the one that was awake and I was asked the questions, I was like, wait, I'm not sure. You know, they could determine that, yes, my memory center, my language center, that were all on the left side, and that right side, which is where the misfiring neurons, the mischievous part of my brain, I call it, it was all local. It was all localized. And so that after that test, they were like, yep, you're a really good surgery candidate. We can do this. We can go forward with this. And you have a pretty high success chance of success. It's a high success rate.
What was the exact surgery that you had?
It was called the right temporal lobectomy.
And so how much of your brain did they remove?
Oh, this is so wild. It's a kiwi-sized piece of brain.
Oh, yeah, not small. I mean, like, kiwis aren't a large fruit, but oh my, like, when you're thinking about your brain, and like, that's wild.
Yeah, so wild that one can do okay if it's the right part, you know? Right, because there are stories I read up on this, and there are people whose memory centers and seizure focal points are in the same place, and then they can't do what they did to me, a resection, that's called. They can't resect the part of the brain because then the person would not be able to speak well. They'd, you know, lose their language ability.
So the surgery itself went well, but the recovery was rough.
Glitchy. We would call it glitchy. So the surgery was on April 29th. And then almost exactly 2 months later, on June 28th, 2014, I woke up and I was using my computer and I felt like I couldn't keep my hands on the keyboard. It was the strangest thing. It was just very minor. I was like, what's this? I don't know what this is. Then we went to the mall to look for shoes for my son. And it was at the mall. My arm started shaking uncontrollably. It was, in retrospect, it was almost stroke-like. And I was still cognitively very aware. And I found my husband. And I said, you see this shaking? I have nothing to do with it. I can't stop it. And then suddenly I was having a seizure. And all of this was triggered by the fact that a subdural hematoma had developed in my head. And so there was all this pressure. And because I was somebody who's prone to seizures, how it manifested itself as obviously a problem was I was having a grand mal seizure in the shopping mall at the shoe store. Again, I feel very blessed. I'm a stone's throw away from MGH at that point. I mean, my house is, that mall is where we were. They call medics. I wound up at MGH. My husband is told there's a subdural hematoma. We have to take it out. And, you know, it's actually life-threatening. So he has to give the consent to the surgery at that point because I'm totally out of it. That surgery was an emergency craniotomy. That's what it went down in as in my records, in my medical records. Survival rate of hematomas is actually pretty low. It's like some things I read said 60% die. Some I read said 80% die. So I look back on that and I'm like, wow, I was really lucky to be as strong as I am. And also that I looked up the guy who did the surgery. I looked up his name and he actually had some expertise dealing with similar things. So I guess I feel very blessed that I live so close to these centers that have access to these experts.
So you have this more than a small hiccup following the surgery, but once you had recovered from the craniotomy, how were you doing?
That was a long haul. They did the craniotomy, they sent me home, and then I was having like grand mal seizures, multiple within a very short time span. So I think I had 4 grand mals in that 7 days after that craniotomy. And they kept sending me home too soon. They don't keep you. And I think that's just not uncommon out there, no matter what hospital you go to. But after that initial week, I was just kind of woozy. They really had to douse me with far more meds than my body was used to. But it's seizures beget seizures. And so the important thing at that point was to put the kibosh on it. So my body didn't relearn, like, this is something, these big tonic clonics are something that you're going to start having regularly again, because if you start having them regularly, then you're more likely to. So I was just very woozy and on a lot of medication. And for that first month after the craniotomy, couldn't be left alone. You know, I had to have somebody, a grown-up, with me at all times. And it took a year, really, to get back to medication levels that felt comfortable. But what was very disconcerting and almost felt like a mean joke is the neuropathy, which is like this tingling sensations I got in my fingers. And why I call that a mean joke is because when I had those grand mals right after the craniotomy, they started with the neuropathy in my fingers. And then as I was recovering, that was kind of an ongoing side effect for a long time, for like years. And every time I felt the neuropathy, I was like, uh-oh, this is it. Am I about to have another tonic-clonic? This is going to be a disaster. And it took me months to realize, you know, not every tingling sensation has to turn into a seizure. It's going to be okay. And I just kind of had to like coach myself through that.
And so in the end, even though it was pretty touch and go there for a moment, the surgery was deemed successful.
It was.
You have not, I'm knocking on all of the wood, but since those initial tonic-clonics after the craniotomy, you have not had another.
I had one in December 15, but I could connect it to the fact that I was tapering off one of my two anticonvulsants. And so the week after I got down to zero Vimpat, I did have a tonic-clonic. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to be a monotherapy girl. I need two meds. And so my doc put me right back on it. And so I take Keppra and Vimpat are the two meds I take. And so that since that day, that was December 5th, 2015, no seizures.
That's incredible. Or the partials either.
No partials either. I have what I phrase or what I call neuroblips here and there, which is just like a fleeting sensation in my tummy, sometimes followed by a swelling sensation at my lips, but no loss of awareness, and ends within 2 to 3 minutes usually. And like the first year after surgery, I had those like, I don't know, 30 times during the course of 12 months. The last time I went to my doc, it was down to like 5 over the course of 12 months. I still track everything. I track everything like a good scientist, because I like to see those numbers go down. It's reassuring.
Yeah, and, absolutely. You're a good patient.
Yeah. That's part of why I had to write the book, is like being a good patient is useful for yourself.
Yeah. So I want to get to that. Your book that you wrote, Seizing Control, talk to us about why you felt the need and what you hope people take away from it.
Yes, sure. I had to write the book partly, as we touched on a moment ago, I wanted patients to know that recovering from a major surgery or managing a chronic condition like epilepsy requires a certain degree of taking ownership of your own healthcare plan and working closely with your doctor. And so that was a huge takeaway for me, having gone through that. You know, you come with your questions, you come with your list of symptoms, and it helps them sort through what's going on and figure out next best steps for your recovery or your healthcare, that kind of thing. And then that was one. And two was, I really wanted people, just everybody, to know what epilepsy is, what a bear it is to manage, try to dispel some of the mystery, some of the stigmas. That's just for everybody. And then for people with epilepsy, I wanted them to know that there are ways to push back, you know, against the discrimination, if that's what you feel like you're undergoing. It's not easy. It was grueling, but it's out there. And even if somebody chooses not to go that path, because it is grueling, at least know that it's them, not you, that has a problem. Them meaning the world around you. You know, epilepsy is a bear to deal with. It's a condition. What is it, 50 million around the world that have it? And so, you know, what I hope is that my book takes at least one small step in the direction of raising awareness, creating a little more empathy, a little more courage. I would grant you that if you're watching a seizure, especially a big one, that's a scary thing to witness. So equip people with knowledge and hopefully courage and empathy. And so that is why I had to write the book. And yeah, I knew I'd be outing everybody.
That's it. Yes, I love the cover so much. Who did the artwork?
Thank you. My mom did that picture of me a long time ago, and I asked her if I could use it.
Well, congratulations on the book. It's called Seizing Control.
If I could just add, you can get it at most book vendors like bookshop.org, Amazon, anywhere you buy books online. I also have my own website, and it's possible to buy it there. www.lauraperetsky.com. And I hope it's helpful. That's why I wrote it. I wanted it to be helpful.
Laura, I so appreciate you sharing your story with us today, and especially, you know, the points of being such a strong self-advocate, be that with your healthcare providers or in the workplace, or with your family. As the patient, you are just as much a part of that care team as the clinicians. And so I just thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura, for sharing your epilepsy journey with us and for your continuing efforts to raise awareness and understanding of epilepsy through your writing. For more than 25 years, Cure Epilepsy has been raising awareness through its unyielding support of epilepsy research. Since 1998, Cure Epilepsy has raised more than $90 million to fund research and other initiatives that will lead the way to cures for epilepsies. If you would like to help us achieve our goal of a world without epilepsy, please visit cureepilepsy.org/donate. Thank you.
The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of Cure Epilepsy. The information contained herein is provided for general information only and does not offer medical advice or recommendations. Individuals should not rely on this information as a substitute for consultations with qualified healthcare professionals who are familiar with individual medical conditions and needs. Cure Epilepsy strongly recommends that care and treatment decisions related to epilepsy and any other medical conditions be made in consultation with a patient's physician or other qualified healthcare professionals who are familiar with the individual's specific health situation.